Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN humanitarians have said that they're in close contact with the Indonesian authorities after a 6.2 magnitude earthquake struck West Sulawesi province in the early hours of Friday. 8 people lost their lives and more than 630 were injured, according to local officials. Heavy damage was reported in the city of Majene, including a 5-story hospital where 8 people were said to be trapped. More than 18,000 have been moved to 10 evacuation sites. These numbers are likely to increase as assessments continue, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. In Geneva, spokesperson Jens Laake said that the earthquake followed a smaller 5.7 magnitude shock, which struck the same area on Thursday afternoon. The epicenter of the latest quake was shallow at 10 kilometers and did not trigger a tsunami warning, he added.
The earthquake interrupted the access road between Majene and the provincial capital, Mamuju, in 3 different locations. Electricity, communications network, and fuel supply have also been disrupted. The United Nations is in very close contact with the Indonesian government, and we stand ready to support the response to assist all the affected people.
Child labour has decreased significantly in the last decade, but 152 million children, 1 in 10 globally, are still caught up in harmful work. The warning from the International Labour Organization, ILO, comes as it kicks off a year-long bid to eradicate the practice. ILO said that the COVID-19 pandemic has considerably worsened the situation for children, but that legislative and practical measures can help reverse the trend. The UN organization's appeal is in line with Target 8.7 of the Sustainable Development Goals, 17 objectives that all countries have agreed to achieve by 2030. Target 8.7 asks member states to take immediate and effective measures to eradicate forced labor, end modern slavery and human trafficking. Countries are also urged to secure the prohibition and elimination of the worst forms of child labor, including the recruitment and use of child soldiers, and by 2025 to end child labor in all its forms. To the Central African Republic, where 120,000 people have now fled election violence, with victims reporting sexual attacks, harassment and pillaging. In an appeal for calm, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said that mass displacement is continuing, reversing a trend of people returning to the country in recent years. Most of those fleeing outside the country have gone to neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo. On Wednesday alone, 10,000 people crossed the Ubangi River, separating the two countries. In addition to the 50,000 refugees in DRC, another 9,000 have reached Cameroon, Chad and the Republic of Congo in the past month. Here's UNHCR spokesperson Boris Chesiakov.
What is clear is that the situation has evolved. It has worsened. We've seen that the number of refugees displaced and moving across borders into neighboring countries has doubled in just 1 week. We were reporting of 30,000 refugees last Friday. Today it's already 60,000, and much of that is the increase we've seen in the DRC. This is coming with reports of intensified violence, that people are being forced to move from their home, and the situation has not calmed down for the moment.
In an appeal for funds, the spokesperson said that the inaccessible terrain along the Ubangi River, where people have sheltered, has complicated aid access. Inside the Central African Republic, another 58,000 people remain displaced. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Dear friends, 2020 has been a year of trials, tragedies and tears. COVID-19 upended our lives and plunged the world into suffering and grief. So many loved ones have been lost, and the pandemic rages on, creating new waves of sickness and death. Poverty, inequality and hunger are rising. Jobs are disappearing and debts are mounting. Children are struggling. Violence in the home is increasing and insecurities everywhere. But the new year lies ahead, and with it we see rays of hope. People extending a helping hand to neighbors and strangers, frontline workers giving their all, scientists developing vaccines in record time, countries making new commitments to prevent climate catastrophe. If we work together in unity and solidarity, these rays of hope can reach around the world. That's the lesson of this most difficult year. Both climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic are crises that can only be addressed by everyone together as part of a transition to an inclusive and sustainable future. The central ambition of the United Nations for 2021 is to build a global coalition for carbon neutrality, net zero emissions, by 2050. Every government, city, business and individual can play a part in achieving this vision. Together, let's make peace among ourselves and with nature. Tackle the climate crisis, stop the spread of COVID-19, and make 2021 a year of healing. Healing from the impact of a deadly virus, healing broken economies and societies, healing divisions, and starting to heal the planet. That must be our New Year's resolution for 2021. I wish you all a happy and peaceful New Year from the United Nations.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The United States' decision to designate Yemen's Houthis as a terrorist organization will likely lead to a large-scale famine not seen for nearly 40 years, the UN Emergency Relief Chief said on Thursday. In his address to the Security Council, Mark Lowcock said that it was not his intention to question the US decision, which was announced last Sunday against Ansar Allah, as the Houthis are formally known. But he noted that Yemenis were already stockpiling whatever they can afford, while humanitarian agencies had long been unanimously opposed to the development, fearing that commercial importers of food, fuel and medicines would walk away from the war-torn country. Their fear is of being caught up in US regulatory action, which would put them out of business or into jail, the UN official explained, before insisting that aid agencies simply cannot replace commercial importers. Latest UN data indicates that 16 million people will go hungry in Yemen this year, nearly 6 years after conflict erupted between the government of President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi and Houthi forces, who control vast stretches of the country. About 50,000 people are essentially starving to death in what is essentially a small famine, Mr. Lowcock told the Security Council, adding that another 5 million are just one step behind them. Four UN peacekeepers from Côte d'Ivoire have been killed in Mali and five others wounded during an attack on Wednesday. The convoy transporting the Blue Helmets was struck by an improvised explosive device, and the troops then came under attack by unidentified gunmen in the vast Timbuktu region, according to the UN mission in Mali. In a statement, the UN Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, or MINUSMA, said that a robust response by the peacekeepers forced the assailants to flee, allowing for the wounded to be evacuated by helicopter. The attack, which has been condemned by the UN Secretary-General, took place on the same day as another assault on UN forces in the Central African Republic, in which a Rwandan peacekeeper was killed. Countries have made some progress in planning for climate change adaptation, but not nearly enough to provide protection against increasing droughts, floods, and sea level rise, the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, has warned. New data published by UNEP found that while around 3 in 4 nations have some adaptation plans in place, financing to pay for implementation has fallen far short of what is needed. Developing countries need to spend around $70 billion a year on coping measures, but this figure is set to reach at least 4 times that in 2050, the UN agency said. Head of UNEP, Inga Andersen, highlighted that climate change impacts will intensify and hit vulnerable countries and communities the hardest, even if nations meet the Paris Agreement goals of holding global warming this century to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Ms. Andersen recalled the UN Secretary-General's appeal for a global commitment to put half of all climate finance towards adaptation projects in the next year. This would provide a huge step up in preparing countries for climate shocks by helping to implement everything from early warning systems to resilient water resources and nature-based solutions, she maintained. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Connor Lennon from UN News. Migration is part of the modern world and it's not going away despite a COVID slowdown, the UN official has told us just ahead of a new UN migration report launched on Friday. Jorge Bravo, the head of the Population Policies and Development Branch at the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs, or DESA, explained to me that it's never been easier or faster to move around the world, which is more integrated and connected than ever before. Although movement restrictions brought in during the COVID-19 pandemic limited migration in 2020, Mr. Bravo said the longer-term trend is still showing an increase in the numbers of people leaving their countries of origin to live elsewhere.
As everybody knows, these days, ever since the pandemic started, it was declared back in March 2020, there has been a unprecedented number of restrictions to all kinds of mobility, both internal, including the lockdowns and restrictions of movement within countries, but also very severely also international migration or international population movements. In terms of the impact on migration, in our international migration stock 2020, in our highlights report, we do include an estimate that the pandemic might have reduced the number of international migrants through mid-2020 by around 2 million globally. And this is a slowdown of the growth in the number of migrants between mid-2019 and mid-2020 by around 27%. So quite significant slowdown in the growth of the number of international migrants.
And this is going against the trend that you've seen over the last 20 years. There's been a big growth in migration, hasn't there?
Correct, right. The big, more longer-term trend has been for migration to keep growing and even a bit faster than the total population growth. So we went from 173 million international migrants, as we defined them in our migration stock estimates in the year 2000, to 22 million in 2010, and up to 281 million in 2020, according to the United Nations' latest estimates.
What are the main drivers of this big change?
Right. So, again, it's fairly obvious that the extension of telecommunications information about places of origin and especially destination has facilitated migration networks and even the cost of transportation of travel has been reduced, as well as transaction costs, meaning the cost of getting installed and finding a job, being able to make a living in the countries of destination. So the vast majority of the people that move internationally do so precisely for employment, education, family, reunification. But there's also been quite a bit of increase in the number of people forcibly displaced from their countries of origin due to conflict, persecution, civil unrest, etc. That's what we call refugees and asylum seekers. That number has gone up as well.
And I suppose it's worth reiterating that whilst most migration is to high-income countries, it's the neighboring countries of countries in conflict that are hosting, sheltering most refugees and migrants.
Correct. You know, those two points that you just made, and even a third one, the basic one is that most migrants really come from middle-income countries, not a majority of low-income countries, and they tend to migrate to other upper middle-income countries and high-income countries, as the World Bank defines them.
And what countries are we talking about? What are the main middle-income countries from where migrants come?
They range from, for example, Mexico to the U.S., Asian countries to Western Asia and to Europe, and even some other Latin American countries, people migrating to Europe or to the U.S. as well as a main destination for all of Latin American countries, including Central America, but also South America as well. But you're right also that the bulk of the refugees and asylum seekers fleeing from the Syrian conflict and other parts of the world typically go to the neighboring. And Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan are big recipients of Syrian and Palestinian refugees as well. And in the Latin American context, for example, the large number of Venezuelans that have left in recent years, the latest estimate is that it's a 3.6 million people. Most of those have gone to neighboring countries in Latin America, including Chile, Peru, Colombia, and others.
Was there anything in this report that did surprise you, strike you as out of the ordinary?
I did not expect, for example, such fast continued growth of migration out of Southern Asia and Northern Africa towards Western Asia. That has continued to increase very fast. It's basically people from Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and other countries. countries in Southern Asia and Central Asia migrating to the GCC countries. This has been going on for a while, but I didn't expect it to continue to grow so fast as we've documented.
And which countries are we talking about when you say the GCC countries?
So these are the oil-producing countries of you know, that part of the world, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, and others of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries.
And do we have any reasons why this has happened at a greater rate than you would have thought?
We haven't researched in depth the reasons for it, other than the continued demand for oil and gas around the world, and the construction boom that is still going on there that requires a lot of additional labor. So the demand is there. The migration networks that had, you know, had started to develop years, if not decades ago, have been extended and are facilitated by communication technologies. So all of that could explain, but we haven't done specific research on that question.
And finally, what would you want the main takeaway for people from this report? What do you think are the main areas of concern that need to be addressed?
Well, to understand basically that migration has always been with us, human migration, that, you know, the modern world, the more globalized, integrated global economy makes it in many ways easier, faster, cheaper to move around. There's good reasons from the development perspective that justify and that are basically driving the demand for labor, in especially in high-income countries, which tend to have slower growth of their working-age population. So they do have a deficit there that is filled by the cohorts of young or at least working-age migrants coming in from parts of the world that have younger population age structures. So that's good for development, not just of the countries of destination, but also countries of origin, as we all know. That may be a big takeaway. Second is what we've already talked about. The vast majority of people migrate to take up job opportunities, education, and family reunification. But also noteworthy is the fast growth of people, population being forcibly displaced across international borders. And it's a big increase of, even faster increase of the refugees and asylum seekers, faster than the total number of migrants internationally. Maybe another takeaway from more the demographic perspective is that almost all of the international migrants are, or almost half of the international migrants are female. There's cross-regional differences, but the bulk, as I said earlier, three-fourths almost of all migrants are in the main working ages, and they contribute economically, as I explained.
Welcome to The State of the Planet, a UN Environment Programme production. I'm Tim Albone, your host. Today, in episode 2, I'm joined by Dr. Henry Neufeld, the head of Section, Impact Investment and Adaptation Analysis at the UNEP-DTU Partnership. Today, Henry and I discuss adaptation and what it means, COVID-19 and its impact on adaptation, planning, finance and implementation, the 2020 Adaptation Gap Report and what it actually shows, and the global stock take that's due in 2023. So, over to the podcast. So, Henry, thank you very much for joining me today on this podcast. We hear a lot about adaptation, and I just wondered if we could start by talking about what exactly that means.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And it's a real pleasure to be here on this podcast. So, when we talk about adaptation, we're talking about a process that is related to responding to climate change to lower climate risks. Ultimately, we do that to reduce the risk we are exposed to or are expected to be exposed to in the future by responding reactively, coping, or in anticipation or planning for these changes that will come. You know, we have different ways of doing this in public sectors and private sectors. They respond to these climate risks, and the way we reduce the climate risks through this process of adaptation is by reducing the exposure to climate hazards, or by reducing the vulnerability or increasing the resilience of people, of communities, of individuals, of countries to these climate risks. And that's basically the process through which we have to address adaptation. This is the process of adaptation. There's a strong link to development here, particularly when it comes to the way we understand adaptation, because there is no measure like the one we have for mitigation. The overarching metric we use is CO2 equivalents, carbon dioxide equivalents. In adaptation, we don't have that. It's a combination, a mix of many, many different metrics that combine together and tell us something about our exposure to these climate hazards and our vulnerability to them. A lot has to do with development. It has to do with the way people can respond because they are sheltered or because they are able to withstand the hazards by public and private means, by reducing their vulnerabilities to these climate hazards. So there's also a link to maladaptation. I think I should mention that when we do adaptation without, or when we do development without considering climate hazards, climate risks, then very often what we result in doing is actually maladaptation, because we don't anticipate the side effects. For instance, when we do adaptation in a watershed and we're not considering what will happen downstream, we might be producing maladaptation downstream to other people. And there is also some form of maladaptation if we don't consider current and future trajectories of climate change, which will also affect the outcomes of our actions. And then there is also a spatial, as I've mentioned, there's a spatial context here. So it's a multidimensional process that needs to be considered. And if we don't take that into account, our coping strategies can often result in maladaptation, and that's not good. And we have to avoid that to the degree possible.
Henry, 2020 has been a bit of a strange year, and I imagine this has also had an impact on adaptation, you know, I mean, particularly COVID-19. Could you talk about how that has affected adaptation?
I mean, this year has been such a strange year, with everybody having to change their behaviors in ways we haven't experienced for at least a century, I think. In the short term, I think COVID-19 is going to affect adaptation in the way that people and governments have to address this urgent, the pandemic urgently. That means their focus has changed from climate change, which was really high on the agenda before COVID hit, to now managing the pandemic, to reducing the number of casualties, the people that die or are really affected by COVID, and also the economic, the socioeconomic fallout of this pandemic that we are all experiencing in terms of loss of income and downturn of the economy. So these are things that are happening and that need to happen in the short term, and that have led to the fact that adaptation and climate change in general has been lower on the agenda than it has been before. In the longer term, I think there's going to be some real impacts of COVID on climate responses, adaptation, but possibly also mitigation, because public sector finance will be much more strapped. There will be less investments in adaptation. And that, of course, is a real problem for particularly for developing countries, which are already much harder hit by COVID than the rich nations. And, you know, they have less capacity, they have less ability to respond to the threats. And then when a finance situation becomes more difficult in the longer term future because of the economic downturn globally, then we will see that developing countries will struggle more and will have more difficulties responding to the growing climate threats and reducing climate risks. So that means that in the longer term, we can expect COVID-19 to be having really strong impacts on adaptation. What we don't know yet is exactly how much that's going to be the case. So it's an ongoing question that we're trying to respond to. We only have limited information with regard to how that will actually work in the longer term. At the same time, I think there is a real opportunity for governments to use the pandemic as an opportunity to bounce back better, to use the opportunity of having to readdress major issues we deal with as a global community with regard to climate resilience and low emission economies. So by investing in green technologies and climate resilient technologies, and by using the means that governments at all levels have to restructuring the investments into these climate resilient, low emission technologies and development pathways, we can use this pandemic as an opportunity to bounce back better. Unfortunately, that is not happening as far as we can see, and this opportunity is being wasted to a large degree.
Henry, the Adaptation Gap Report mentions planning, finance, and implementation to help bridge the adaptation gap. What does that mean practically? Could you talk about that a little bit?
So we structured the Adaptation Gap Report around planning, finance, and implementation because they are key dimensions of adaptation. We not only adaptation, also mitigation, if you think about it that way. But in the mitigation process, you know, we have this overarching metric, which we don't have for adaptation. And our best bets in addressing the process of adaptation as it's being implemented at national levels, which is the focus of our report, is by looking at the ambition that countries put forward through their plans in adaptation, by laws, by climate strategies, nationally determined contributions, their national adaptation plans. These are the instruments which governments have to explain what they're planning to do and how they view climate risks in the future being addressed. At the same time, we need to look at the finance of implementing adaptation. Finance is part of the means of implementation, which also include technology and capacity. But without finance, any priority we talk about that doesn't have a budget line is just, in my view, hot air. So finance is a measure of commitment that we make to address adaptation. If there is an element of support provided by developed countries, and then there is, of course, also an element of support received by developing countries. So that's that's important to bear in mind. And both elements here of support are important in the context of adaptation finance. So planning, finance, and then of course implementation in the context of the actions that countries undertake to address climate risks. And in the context of the support provided and received, ultimately lead to the results that we need to look at in the context of adaptation. And very often these actions are still in progress. Very few have
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. Far greater scientific cooperation is needed to quickly identify and study emerging variants of the COVID-19 virus, the World Health Organization, WHO, has said. To date, 350,000 sequences of the new coronavirus have been shared, but most are from just a handful of countries. In addition to monitoring the coronavirus's mutations, virus and serum samples should be shared via globally agreed mechanisms, WHO scientists believe, so that critical research can happen. This new platform will help inform global disease control efforts, said WHO's Anna Maria Hanau Restrepo, at a virtual meeting convened by the agency on Tuesday that was attended by more than 1,700 experts from 124 countries. Improving the geographic coverage of sequencing is critical for the world to have eyes and ears on changes to the virus, added Maria van Kerkhove, WHO technical lead on COVID-19. The UN's labour agency, ILO, has called for greater protection for the hundreds of millions of people who work from home, as new research has shown that they are usually worse off than those who work outside the home, even in higher skilled professions. According to the ILO, home workers earn around 13% less in the United Kingdom, 22% less in the United States, 25% less in South Africa, and around 50% less in Argentina, India, and Mexico. Prior to COVID-19, there were approximately 260 million home-based workers globally, representing almost 8% of global employment. However, in the first few months of the pandemic, an estimated 1 in 5 workers found themselves working from home. Data for the whole of 2020, once available, is expected to show a substantial increase over the previous year. Home workers include teleworkers who work remotely year-round and a vast number involved in the production of goods that cannot be automated, such as embroidery, handicrafts, and electronic assembly. A third category, digital platform workers, provides highly specialized services, such as data annotation for the training of artificial intelligence systems. The ILO's report warns that many of these invisible workers endure poor working conditions, face greater health and safety risks, and lack access to training. An expert UN rights panel in Geneva has urged the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, to pursue an investigation into the murder of rights activist Pascal Kabungulu 15 years after he was killed in front of his family. Mr. Kabungulu, who spoke out against corruption and impunity, worked for the human rights group Héritiers de la Justice. It uncovered and documented violations and war crimes in DRC. The 55-year-old was slain in 2005 by 3 armed men wearing masks and uniforms who broke into his house in the eastern town of Bukavu. Denouncing the extrajudicial killing, the UN Human Rights Committee said that more than 15 years after the crime, no date has been set for a murder trial. The panel underlined the silence and inaction of the country's judicial bodies, which are no longer even able to locate the case file, as the reason why Mr. Kabungulu's family turned to the committee to ask for help. In a call for a prompt and transparent probe into Mr. Kabungulu's death, the committee said that it regretted the lack of cooperation by the DRC in bringing justice to his family. The protection of human rights defenders is fundamental to ensuring a just society based on the rule of law, it insisted. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello and welcome to UN Catch-Up, Dateline Geneva, a weekly review of international events that are making the headlines at the United Nations. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Daniel Johnson, and in today's show, we'll be hearing about UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet's update to member states on the situation in Belarus, also efforts to get aid into Ethiopia's Tigray region, and for the world's workers, a warning from the International Labour Organization that COVID-19's impact on wages is only just getting started. That's all in the news bulletin, coming right up. But first, we're off to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where we're going to find out about how UN broadcaster Radio Okapi is busy providing life-saving and trusted information on COVID-19 to its many millions of listeners, not just on the new coronavirus, in fact, but on deadly Ebola disease, which is endemic in the country, along with cholera, measles and malaria. This is a massive task, almost as vast as the country itself, which is the size of Western Europe and home to the UN peacekeeping mission MONUSCO. But it's more urgent than ever, as the country faces a new infection spike in all provinces. To help understand how Radio Okapi is tackling the problem of rumours and misinformation, I spoke to the station's head of strategic communication and public information, Christophe Bulierac. I started by asking him for the latest news on COVID-19 in DR Congo.
Unfortunately for COVID, we are now in a situation where we receive signal of an increase of a second wave of COVID in mostly in Kinshasa, but also in Kivu and in most of the provinces of the DR Congo. So it's just, you know, it's just coming back. We have to take all the measures of precaution. I must say that the situation is not the same here in DR Congo, with lots of economic problems, lots of problems of peace and security. So there was all the, you know, it's difficult in some part of Kinshasa to see some people who are wearing masks now. But there is clearly a need, given the alarming signal that we received, to resensitize. And that's what we have done since the beginning on Radio Okapi, but we are going to talk about that.
Absolutely. And I should say that, or maybe you could give us a bit of insight into Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's a vast country. So how do you go about tailoring your programming to the different needs of the country? How many transmitters do you have, for example, over there?
We have 40 transmitters. Radio Okapi is actually the radio number one in the country, less and less in Kinshasa because there is some competition, which is very good, actually, very healthy. But in the rest of the country, we are the radio number one. We have a cumulative weekly audience of 23 million people, 40 transmitters in most of the provinces of the country, and we are also developing some partnership with local communities. That's a radio, that's a UN radio that was born in 2002, you say it, and our daily struggle is to provide credible and reliable information about all the country. And of course, we broadcast in five languages, French, but also Lingala, Swahili, Kikongo, Chiluba. And I must add a few other languages in the recent studio and local program that we have put in place in the Kivu during the last Ebola epidemics, where we needed also to be able to speak to people, because that's what it's about, right? Radio is to speak to communities. And we also add some local languages like Kinande. And we now get the feedback that, you know, that was extremely important to speak to people in a context of a pandemic, because there is a lot of resistance. There were a lot of rumors. That was true for Ebola. That's true for COVID. And that's always a clear necessity to speak to people and to be listened. And you know that people, even in a country, in a huge country like Congo, they are very demanding. If they don't like the radio program, they will switch it off. So we need to be a useful radio. Its DNA is really the focus on reliability and credibility.
It's great that you mentioned credibility, because trust obviously is so important. Your listeners actually trust what you say. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with one of your colleagues, one of your reporters last year. And she was saying that one of the things that people understand about Okapi is that the information is verified. So it's not going to be immediately perhaps available, but it will take perhaps a little bit longer to verify. And that really brings me to my question. How do you keep up with social media and the misinformation that surrounds not only COVID, but Ebola and all sorts of things? You know, there's lots of unfounded information out there. So how do you keep pace with it?
Yeah, your question is at the heart of what we are doing now, because we are engaged in the process of transforming Radio Okapi in a B media. It's a radio station, so we manipulate 20, 30 news every day. Some of them are very sensitive, and these news are broadcasting on air. But we also want these news to be on the social media quickly, because the situation, the way to consume, to access information in Congo is also changing very rapidly, particularly in the cities, and we need to cope with that. We need to follow this process. I omitted to tell you that the Facebook page of Radio Okapi is the biggest Facebook page in the DR Congo as well. So for us, we have right now limited capacity in community management, but for us, the main things through our Facebook page, through our Twitter account, Instagram, but also our website. The website of Radio Capi is also very, very well followed, not only in Congo, but also abroad among the diaspora and others. It's about, you know, again, providing the right and verified news. And that's often enough, you know, when you have a credibility to ensure that rumors and fake news are not considered as credible.
But how can I just jump in there quickly? How do you nip those rumors in the bud? I mean, maybe give me some specific reactions and responses to confronting misinformation about not only Ebola but COVID. Some of the talk shows that you have, how do you directly stay in contact with your listener base?
We have three main programs. The three most popular programs of Radio Capi are interactive. We allow the listeners from all the provinces of this huge country, 80 times Belgium. When you take a plane, you need to fly for three hours to go on the other side. So we get within 1 hour some calls from the east, from the west, from the north, from the south of the country. They often ask questions very upfront to our guests or to ourselves. They often convey rumors and misinformation, and that's a very efficient way to ensure that this misinformation are not circulating further. But that's not enough, of course. It's very important to listen to people, to give them the opportunity to speak and to answer to them. But of course, we also need to work at the same time on the Facebook page, the social media. It's more important, you're right, for us to be credible than to be fast. That being said, you know, we also need to be fast, just because if you are not fast, you give the space for all the disinformation to grow up. So we are currently reorganizing internally Radio Capi so that we can send notifications on the social media. We don't want to be in a position where we have to wait for the first radio news bulletin to provide an important information. We need to put it on the website before.
Thank you for that. That really is fascinating insight into how a traditional radio station is evolving to meet the needs of this fight against misinformation. Just tell me why it could be harmful in the Ebola context. You know, there were people who were dying because they were afraid of going to get help, weren't they?
Yes, I mean, what I heard in DR Congo during the latest Ebola epidemics in Ecuador, in the Kivu, was pretty much similar than what I heard when I was in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone a few years ago in West Africa during the big Ebola crisis. There is, during this time, especially in areas where there are peace and security issues, everything is integrated, everything is mixed, right? You think that you need to provide the right information so that people just take the right measures or are not hostile to the medical team. But it's more complex than that, because there are clearly people who don't want peace, who don't want the disease or the outbreak to be stopped because it generates money or it generates chaos, and this chaos is actually good for their own private interest. So that becomes extremely complex. And I guess the right thing is to be able to reach people, to reach the communities. And the radio station, of course, is unique. Not the only one, but that's a unique tool. And to do it with the right message at the right time, using the right language and doing repetition. You know, radio is very important in Africa, and the radio podcast also can be sent on digital platforms. So there was some hostility towards the medical teams, and that was extremely dangerous for the humanitarian agents who work in the context of Ebola at some point, given insecurity. And there were lots of challenges, logistic challenges. Again, it's a huge country, so the problems are incredible here. And that's good to hear the local authorities first to say that the radio station was instrumental. It's not us who say that. It's them. I was in Butembo one month ago.
That's in the northeast.
That's in the northeast, and that's near Beni. In Beni, you have armed group ADF who are killing the population, the civilians. At the same time, you had Ebola. Can you imagine how all of this is intricating and how it's difficult to fight against an outbreak into that? And the reason why we have created new studio in this northeast part of Congo is because we were asked by the local authorities say we need Radio Kapi to speak specifically to our population and convince our population that the people who come to fight against Ebola are not their enemies, because some spoilers tell them that they are the enemies. So it's just a very clear reminder that radio broadcast is incredibly, if it's well done and if it's really targeting the right audience, it's incredibly useful to fight pandemics. That was, I just want to say that was not the first raison d'être of Radio Kapi, right? Radio Kapi is not in Congo to fight pandemics, but it's the, what is interesting is how we use this tool to also fight pandemics on fighting, on sensitization, but also on education.
Very last question to you, Christoph. It would be really insightful to understand how you personally and your team have coped with COVID. I mean, radio stations are less complicated than TV, that's for sure, but still, they need a certain minimum level of material and gear to make things work. How did you cope with the restrictions placed on you because of COVID?
Well, that was like in many countries, it was just a new situation, lots of fears, lots of anxieties, lots of rumors. People didn't know where we would go, the long-term consequences of that at that time. We had quite little knowledge at the beginning, if you remember well, about this disease. We had several staff that were tested positive. We lost one colleague, and we had no other choice than we didn't want to stop the radio. You don't shut down the radio at a time where people are at home and listen the radio and need the radio even more than usually. We had to find the technical way to continue broadcasting without any staff in the office. And we managed, each staff managed to... present the news from home. We pre-recorded, we were sometimes live, and we managed to maintain our sensitization on COVID in all of Congo. Our news, reliable news, because it's not because there is COVID that the problems stop in terms of peace and security, and we managed to keep our audience. That was great. That's not over now. We are not back to normal, but of course, we know now that we are able to continue broadcasting even if everybody has to go back home.
Christoph Bouliorak from Radio Kapi in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, thank you for this insight. I thought I was busy until I just spoke to you, so I will let you get on with your many various challenges, and we look forward to speaking to you again. Look after yourself.
Christoph Bouliorak from Radio Kapi in Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now it's time for the news. Hundreds of people continue to be arrested every week during demonstrations in Belarus, where protesters have been systematically and violently dispersed, UN Human Rights Chief Michel Bachelet said at the Human Rights Council. Speaking on Friday in Geneva, the High Commissioner for Human Rights expressed deep concern about use of force violations by the security forces. Ms. Bachelet, who maintained that the situation in Belarus had seen no improvement since protesters began contesting the result of presidential elections in August, said that reportedly around 1,000 people were arrested on the 8th of November and 700 on the 15th. She told member states that allegations of injuries caused by crowd dispersal measures and of ill treatment during arrests have continued to emerge, and that at least four people had died.
Numerous accounts describe demonstrators and passers-by being randomly chased, kicked, and severely beaten with batons during the dispersal of rallies. We also have multiple and credible reports of people beaten by members of the security forces during and after their transport to police stations or detention centers. If confirmed, such incidents should constitute ill treatment and in some cases may amount to torture.
In reply, Belarus's permanent representative to the UN in Geneva, Yuri Ambrazovich, said that most people were continuing with their normal lives in the country and that the government was functioning, as were factories and offices. The UN is doing its utmost to secure aid access to Ethiopia's Tigray region, it said on Friday, after a deal was struck to reach displaced civilians affected by weeks of fighting between federal and regional forces. The development comes after an earlier announcement that the Ethiopian government had authorized unimpeded, sustained and secure humanitarian access to reach those in need across areas now under its control in the northeast of the country. In Geneva, UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Babar Balogh said that more than 47,000 Ethiopian refugee arrivals had reached Sudan so far, with more expected. But there's still concern for tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees still inside Tigray. Here's World Food Programme spokesperson Thompson Feary.
WFP's priority is to locate some of the 50,000 Eritrean refugees who, before the conflict, received food assistance in four camps in Tigray. It is possible that some may have fled by now in search of safety.
The impact of the conflict on civilians is also a major worry, amid warnings from the World Health Organization, WHO, that the worsening of the COVID-19 pandemic was to be expected, along with injuries, malnutrition, and communicable diseases such as malaria. Finally, global pressure on wages from COVID-19 will not stop with the arrival of a vaccine, the head of the International Labour Organization, ILO, has warned. ILO Director General Guy Ryder was speaking at the launch of the UN body's flagship Global Wage Report, which is published every 2 years. It showed how the pandemic had slowed or reversed a trend of rising wages across the world, hitting women workers and the low-paid hardest. "It's going to be a long road back, and I think it's going to be turbulent, and it's going to be hard," Mr. Ryder told journalists. Except for China, which was bouncing back remarkably quickly, according to the UN data, most of the world would take a considerable period of time to get back to where it was before the pandemic. And this had dealt an extraordinary blow to the world of work almost overnight, the ILO chief said on Wednesday. He explained that there was at least a strong likelihood that as wage subsidies and government interventions are reduced, as they will be over time, that we are likely to face continued downward pressure on wages. According to ILO's report, after 4 years when wages grew on average by 0.4 to 0.9% annually in advanced G20 economies and 3.5 to 4.5% in emerging G20 economies, wage growth slowed or reversed in 2/3 of countries. So that was the news. So let's wrap this up, but not before we have heard from our guests, Solange Behotege-Cortez and Alpha Diallo from the UN Information Service here in Geneva. Solange, to you first. What are your thoughts then on what Christophe had to say about trust building and the need to really fight this misinformation scourge that is so prevalent and preventing people from getting the right information?
Well, hi, Daniel. Hi, everybody. I like very much when Christopher said that during the last Ebola crisis, he heard similar things from Ecuador to Sierra Leone, Liberia. I mean, this is something that we are living also now with the COVID. The virus is everywhere, but the misinformation is everywhere also. It reminds me one of the stories we did with Eunice.
Eunice being the UN Information Service, and there are lots of them around the world. Sorry for the acronyms, listeners. Carry on, Solange, excuse me.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah, and the story was in Senegal, and Damian Cardona, the director of Eunice, you already spell it, thank you, said that he loved to listen Radio Okapi because the radio links Latin and African rhythms. This is exactly what I think we need to do to build bridge within cultures. And they did, using music to sensibilize the local populations in each language, in very much languages, to sensibilize about COVID. And it works because music is a universal language.
That reminds me about another story which you reported on this year, Solange, from Bolivia. And this time you highlighted the work of a young rapper called Criso, who is in El Alto, which is a city at, 3,000 meters above La Paz. And he was a rapper who used to earn his living down in the city, but COVID put a stop to all of that, and he had to turn to recycling and earning, you know, pennies, I think, really, to get by. And he really was struggling. But then he got into an initiative with the information service down there, Yo en Quarantena, sorry for the pronunciation, Me in Quarantine. And he used music there to get in touch with young people and explain about COVID and really to express some solidarity. Maybe you could put some more flesh on that story for me.
Yeah, you pronounce it well. Yo en Cuarentena. And this story was powerful because Criso is a young rapper and he worked with the UN team in Bolivia. And it was really powerful because he used hip-hop to sensibilize about COVID. And here again, hip-hop is, I would like to say, it exists everywhere, not only in one country. So we, again, if misinformation is a global issue, then the answer is also global. And this is what the hip-hop was doing, and very effective because he lives there. he suffered there. He was without work. I mean, he needed to survive. Like in when Christoph talked about local populations in Africa, he said, I mean, there is economic issues. We cannot just think, okay, put a mask or do this and that. I mean, they have real economic problems. And Criso, even with all his problems, he wanted to help. He wanted to be part of the solution, singing and doing what he knows to do.
Thank you for that, Solange. And quickly to you, Alpha, if I may, it would be interesting to hear your insight, because you and I together here at UN Geneva, we've covered the Ebola crisis, not only in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but there are so many similarities, aren't there, between the approach to how you tackle something as deadly as Ebola, as you might also approach COVID. And the question of trust is one that's really important too, getting the trust of the communities and overcoming stigma. What do you think about what Christoph said? Did that bring up any memories of our coverage of Ebola in the past?
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you, Solange. Yes, that's right. It's not enough to have a vaccine. And regarding what Christoph Bulerak said, it's not enough to have a vaccine to treat the disease. You have to get also the support of the community, or your health intervention won't work. And I think the World Health Organization has said this time and again at press conference over the years in Geneva, there is also a question of respecting traditional beliefs. In Ebola, it was often the funeral practice that transmitted the disease after mourners became infected by touching the defunct. So it's this kind of thing can only be addressed by people who have the trust of the community. And I want to conclude, Dan, by evoking some lessons from Ebola in West Africa, where the community engagement was one of the key to stop the spread of disease. And in the fight against COVID-19, it highlights the importance of building trust, working with the healthcare workers and communities.
Thank you, Alpha. I know that is something that all of the humanitarian coordinators of the United Nations, and I'm sure all humanitarians, would echo, because one of the things they say to us when we talk to them is, oh my goodness, I've got so many meetings, I can't get into the field enough, because that's where you stay in contact with people and that's where you really understand what the needs are on the ground. So that issue of trust is obviously very difficult to define, but it's something that you can't do without. And I think, Solange and Alpha, unless you have anything else to say, that brings us to the end of our first UN catch-up, Dateline Geneva. I don't know what you think. We will take this forward. Listeners, if you're happy with this, we would love to hear from you at UN Geneva. Just get in touch with the information service, and maybe you have a story that you'd like to share, because we'd like to hear from you. So it just remains for me to thank Solange Berhotege-Cortez and Alpha Diallo from UN Geneva. My name is Daniel Johnson. Until next time.